This is a very remarkable season. I was reflecting on it. We celebrated Yogananda's Mahasamadhi March 7th, which was yesterday. Tomorrow is the anniversary of the departure of Sri Yukteswar. A couple of weeks later,
do you want to just stand there the whole time? And if I get boring, you kind of... My jokes are bad. All right, let's try it again. Let's see. Oh, I was talking about that this is the time when a great many of our masters, we have five masters on our altar. One of them doesn't have a birth or a death time, which is Babaji. Lahiri Mahashaya's birth and departure were in September. But Master was March 7th, Sri Yukteswar. Just a second. Sri Yukteswar is March 9th, which is tomorrow. Then Easter always comes at the same time of year, and Swami also left on April 21st. So it's really, Master said that funerals are the funerals of all sorrow. I was trying to find a sort of delicate way to say this. Like, this is the death season, you know. But I know that not everyone says that with such a smile. From my point of view, it's departure is just as much to be celebrated as arrival. Departure is a completion of the story. Yes, sometimes departure is a grave disappointment for some of those people who don't get to depart. Sometimes it's a disappointment for those who have to leave also. But in the case of our masters, it's entirely different. And yet at the same time, there's this absolutely inevitable, completely human part of the story. When in our reading today, it's about dogmatism and common sense. And there's many different ways that that can be described. But common sense also has to be applied to the spiritual path, in the sense that we cannot stop being ourselves merely because we've become devotees. And I think one of the really hard things that many people, including myself, have gone through on the spiritual path is that the principle, the dogma, so to speak, is that self-realization is just there. All we have to do is improve our knowing. And I've shared with you at different times, when I first came onto the spiritual path and I heard Master's phrase, you carry within you a portable paradise, for some reason I put a 5-year span on that in my own mind. Like, where I got that number, I haven't any idea. But there was really this internal thought that it will take me about 5 years to do this. And then I'll just have the portable paradise, and anytime anything bothers me, I'll just open the little door and just go in there. I don't actually remember having like a 5-year mark in which the agonizing truth came in on me. But in retrospect, I sort of made up an idea, and then afterwards just acted as if that idea had some validity. And also what happens to us, we hear that the spiritual path is pure bliss, that time is an illusion, that the masters are always with us. And somewhere that dogma, which is extraordinarily, is not a dogma, it's a principle, and it's a true principle, we lose our common sense in relationship to it. And we start imagining that everything that we've been can just be dissolved by wishful thinking. I was remembering years ago when Swami Kriyananda moved to San Francisco. It was 1979, and that was when we were first expanding, really seriously expanding from Ananda Village as our only center. He'd already started a small center in Sacramento. As he said it later, it was sort of his fallback position was Sacramento. But San Francisco was a much greater center of influence, so his serious effort was to start a center in San Francisco. And so he went to live there in the summer of 1979. And would that be correct? I think that's when it was. I volunteered for that. I would phrase it differently. I inserted myself into that project. I was feeling quite restless at Ananda Village. Things weren't nothing was interesting to me. He was going, it looked like fun. So I more or less asked if I could go along. I never did that again. Because I didn't belong in the project. The project had its own, cast of characters, and I actually wasn't one of them, and I messed up the plot. So he basically allowed me to come because he was very, very sensitive to our feelings. And he allowed me to come, but he kind of kept me out of the project. He was doing some recording at that time. He had a reel-to-reel tape recorder, and he was so deficit in techies that I actually became his recording engineer, which was just crazy, really crazy. But anyway, that's what I did. In fact, when I was listening to last night to the poem of Samadhi with the classical, the planets, the piece behind it, I recorded that for Swami. I mean, I pressed the buttons. He recorded it. I just pressed the buttons. It was pretty simple. But he kept me doing that so that I would stay out of the project. And then every time he went back and forth to Ananda Village, which was every other weekend or every weekend, he always took me with him. And, you know, some people thought it was some kind of preferential treatment, but he was just trying to keep me out of San Francisco until I figured out that it wasn't really for me. But in the midst of that, we were trying very hard to build the work there, and Swamiji himself was doing a great deal of teaching, and Swami had a system that he had developed when he was building Ananda in the 60s, which is he would always give a free lecture, and then he would give a paid series of classes, and that was his absolute way of doing it. But we were a little unclear on the concept many times, and we set up a program for him all the way up in Santa Rosa. He had to drive all the way from the city up there. But we just started the class series, and we didn't give a free lecture, and about four people came. And it was, you know, an hour and a half drive for Swami. It was a little bit of an embarrassment for those who were involved. So one of us tried to cover, it may have been me, I don't know who said it. I blissfully don't remember who said it, that means it was probably me. Said, "Oh, Swamiji, Divine Mother just sent those who were meant to come," like that. Swami went, "Please, allow a little space for human error," he said like that. And I've always remembered that, because this is where you have to use your common sense as well as the principles that are involved. And it is a razor's edge. It's a real razor's edge, because in the end of our soul's long journey, we have to come to the understanding that none of this ever happened. I mean, this is, again, these are principles that I read that I used to recite more glibly than I recite now. That when realization comes, when you're a Jivan Mukta, you still have to look back at all your incarnations and realize that there was never a separate individuality acting, that it was always God acting through you, and that there was never really a John Smith who did all those murderous things, but it was always God acting through you. And just the thought of that is so liberating. It's just extraordinarily freeing to realize, because it's such a mystery to me how thought lingers, how the mind replays incidents, how one has conversations that never, you know, that I wish I could have said, or one repeats in one's mind things that were said, or there's an ache somewhere that you don't even know where it comes from. If none of this ever happened, what is all of that? And I'm not able to answer this for you. I really don't know how. And I spent a lot of my spiritual life essentially suppressing common sense with principle. Like Swami would say, a devotee doesn't get angry, so I'm not angry. A devotee isn't resentful, so I'm not resentful. I mean, I wasn't that terrible. But there was an inclination that way, that we have many different ways of overcoming suffering, which is really all that we're trying to do. That's what the whole path is about, isn't it? Just trying to overcome suffering. I'm listening to Stephen sing this beautiful song, "Never grieve to be alone. Go within you, there's your home." Now, isn't that a glorious commentant? That's the portable paradise Master talked about. Never grieve to be alone. He says it so sweetly and so beautifully in that melody, and I was listening to music as language, and the little, at the very ending part that Karen just plays on the piano, where the melody just says that same thing about grief and loneliness and going home. But it isn't the kind of, the way the music goes at the end, it's not the kind of crashing chords like Broadway musicals where everything just resolves, you know, bang like that, but not really. It just gets you into a state of excitement and makes you think that it's all going to be okay until 5 minutes later when it's not. Because if we've just organized the world outside there, then sooner or later it shifts. I'm not very much into, slang or the way people talk, because I really dropped out of society I dropped out when I was about 19, really, and I never actually really went back in, ever. I made it all the way through. And so a lot of times trendy language happens, and I only hear it somewhat later. And someone was talking to me, they had just started a romance that turned into marriage, and they were very happy about it. And I mean, it was all that was nice. There's nothing, I'm not saying anything against any of that. And the woman said to me, the phrase was, "He really gets me." And I had to think for a minute, because it has another meaning, which is, he really gets me, you know. And I knew that wasn't what was being said to me. But of course, what was being said was, he understands. He knows where I'm coming from. He understands my sense of humor. You know, he can see who I am. And I was reflecting on that when I was hearing Steve, you know, never grieve to be alone. But all of us, sooner or later, sort of have that moment, don't we? Where we just know that no matter how much someone loves you, no matter how hard they try, there's always a deep part of ourselves that is just completely ours, except that the divine lives within us, that the guru lives within us. You know, the Swamiji remarked about his relationship to Master. There was one person in the world whose misunderstanding I never had to fear. And of course, I have to say that was my whole relationship with Swamiji. Is that he understood me. I'm not going to use slang because slang can't work to describe something like that. He always understood me. And when I didn't understand myself, and profoundly when other people didn't understand me, he always did. I remember him saying to me on one occasion, "So-and-so, they think this about you, but I know differently." And it was just, the first time he said that, it was like, oh my gosh. There is a reality where we are not alone. But it isn't because this person or that person or these children. My original goal in life before I found the spiritual path was that I would have many, many children. I see all of that. You know, it's fascinating. I know my own self better than I know anyone else, of course. But it's fascinating for me to see, at least in my life, I have been absolutely consistent since my earliest memories. Just absolutely consistent in what I was seeking. Of course, as life has unfolded, as recently as yesterday, I have a more and more subtle understanding of how to attain what I'm seeking. Because our ideas are formed from past life experiences and not necessarily from wisdom. But there was that essential feeling of being alone in this world. I was born into a very nice family. I was always respected and always loved. I mean, there's nothing I can say. It was always ironic to me that there was nothing to complain about and yet nothing was right. You know, and there was no way to put that together until I found the spiritual path, fortunately young. But I thought the idea is that I would have many children. One, it would be meaningful work. And the second would be then I wouldn't be alone. I mean, how many people we marry, we have children, we do all these things so that I won't be alone. And the terrible reality of that is sooner or later, it comes back. It comes back because everything here is a dream. And even though we can make that dream, and even though we can experience, and this is the important part, we can experience reality through the dream. We can experience reality in the dream, actually. It just depends on which way we're looking at it. And I've shared this with you, but it's a very important point. I used to think that Swamiji was not experiencing the dream. And I thought he was holding himself aloof. And so I imitated that, not understanding the difference between fear and freedom. This is common sense, and the principles involved, the application of them is exceedingly subtle. And the characteristic of a master is they're absolutely unafraid. I was listening, as I often do, to the series of recordings that were the last ones that Swami made, which are called Ask Me About Truth. There's 108 of them. And Dharmadas and Nirmala sit in a chair over here, and Swami sits in a chair over here, and he has a microphone stuck on his shawl like this, and they pretend to know less about the path than they actually do, and then ask Swami about truth. But every so often, consistently, their wonderful friendship breaks through, and there's just, it's absolutely Swamiji at his best. Just casually talking, discussing things, and they ask questions, and they're very extremely astute, and the questions flow, and I love it. It's absolutely marvelous. And in that, Nirmala asked a question about courage, which led to the word discouraged, which, of course, is the opposite of courage. And she asked Swamiji if Master was ever discouraged. You know, it's interesting when you just start asking random questions, the things that come up. Swami said, oh, never, never. He said that was one of the many things that Swamiji found so magnetic about him, is that his attitude in every situation was perfect. But then he said, because I immediately thought, but there was a time I understood when Master went to Mexico and he wasn't even sure he would ever come back. So Swami starts answering that. He said, it's not that Master didn't struggle. He said he was betrayed and vilified and sued in the law courts and, you know, had people disappoint him. It wasn't that the dream worked for Master. The dream didn't work for Master any better than it worked for the rest of it. But Master, and sometimes, this is how Swami put it, sometimes Master needed to get away from the whole thing, you know, just that the whole thing was too much for him. And Swamiji, on more than one occasion, felt the same way. When Ananda was being vilified in the press and vilified in the courts, and we had our own Armageddon we had to go through. At one point, Swami left for Hawaii, and he wasn't sure he would come back. It was just, I didn't sign up for this sort of feeling. That's how he put it for Master. I didn't sign up for it is not true. But the way he described Master was, this is not, let me think how he said it exactly. I don't care about any of this. I just want to love God. I'm not trying to make anything happen. I just want to love God. That's why I'm here. And then I've been drawn into all of this conflict and all of this struggle and all of this fight. But that's the way the dream goes. But then Master would just come back. He was never discouraged. So then Nirmala asked a different question. Because he had faith. Are you saying because he always had faith? Yes, Swami said. He always knew that God was the only reality. So that's what I mean about we can experience the eternal in the temporary. We can experience the everlasting in the dream, because everything in creation is the same. Everything is God's reality, but we have this thought. We have this thought that some things are and some that aren't, and we feel very alone. We just feel very alone. And among other reasons why the disciple-guru relationship is celebrated by the masters themselves is because is the end of that aloneness. It is not yet God realization to become a disciple, but it's the beginning of a relationship in which we have no fear of being misunderstood. Now, and that the comfort of that is startling, really. This is where the divine mother aspect of God, Jesus called it the comforter, which is just a word that has so much power to it. That's what the feminine is. And the guru is God, is father, mother, friend, everything together. He is the window, the doorway, the portal through which those divine states are realized. When we read in Autobiography of a Yogi about Master finding Sri Yukteswar, and Master was acting out a lila, but he was living the dream. Not in the way that the slang is meant, but he was actually living in the dream. The masters do not suppress their involvement because they're not afraid. So Master became a devotee searching. He became a devotee longing to meet his master. And then the story in the autobiography where Master hears in his meditation, "Thy master cometh today." And then he's out on the streets of Varanasi. If any of you have ever been to that city, it's not, it sounds very romantic, but it's quite down to earth, let's just put it that way. And he's walking, and he sees this figure at the end of the alleyway. And he's very powerfully drawn, but he keeps going. But then he finds that his feet, he can't walk away. It's so beautifully stated from so many levels. He can't walk away. And he feels that master is drawing him. So he tells the story humorously. He puts a pile of packages in the hands of his fellow monk and then goes rushing back. And immediately, as soon as they're together, no introduction, no words, no details of who I am or anything. Immediately, they know who they are. This was not the first time. This was not the first time that the sun had shone on us together and Master saying, "Me," kneeling at his feet. You know, and then Swamiji has told us over and over again what it meant to him to meet Master. At the end of Swamiji's life, those of you who heard him, even almost in the last 10 years, but certainly in the last 5 years, it didn't really matter what topic you gave Swami. You could almost look at your watch. Within 3 or 4 minutes, he would be telling you the story of meeting Master. Because at that point in Swami's life, in those last years, there was no other reality. He'd been rescued from delusion by the intercession of his master. And everything else was a dream. I mean, all the accomplishments, all the struggles, all the betrayals, all the suffering, all the long days and nights. I've never raised children, but many people tell me when you have that infant and you're not sleeping and the baby has colic and it just never seems to stop. And then you turn around and they're teenagers. They say the days are long, but the years are short. And I think that's true on the spiritual path. I think the incarnations seem long, but eternity is short. And when we finally actually do see what the masters have done for us, there's no other way. In the path, Swami tells the story about the needlepoint picture of Sri Yukteswar. A friend was telling me, reminding me of this, that this man gathered walnuts by the side of the road. He didn't have much money. He used the money to buy yarn, and then with that yarn, he needle-pointed a picture of Sri Yukteswar, which he lovingly gave to Master. Master was so touched by it that he hung it outside his room, and it's still hanging there at Mount Washington. And every time he would go in or out, he would stop. Now here's Master. You think of him, you know, as, well, we think of him rightly, as a God-realized master. But every time he goes in or out, he bows to his guru. And Jesus later, you know, when John the Baptist comes and the very confusing story of, you know, Jesus is now the figure to whom the whole world looks, and John the Baptist is just the one who comes in advance to announce him. John doesn't want to initiate, doesn't want to baptize Jesus. But Jesus says it's in the fitness of things that you would do so. Master explains that John the Baptist was Jesus' guru. And in their previous life as Elijah and Elisha, Jesus had received God realization, although really from long before then even. But nonetheless, it's in the fitness of things. So there is this gratitude that is beyond any words that can put to it. You know, grieve not, you are not alone. And this is what the masters bring to us. They come to the world, they stand with us for a time, and we celebrate their life, their incarnation, because it exemplifies it. It changes it from principle into actual experience. Oh, this is what it looks like. And then from the idea of being loved, it gives us the experience. From the idea of someone actually knowing me, it gives us the experience. And then, of course, that changes everything. God bless you.
Fleeting scenes move by us like a dream. Cling not, none will be your own. Never grieve to be alone. Go within you, there's your home. Life flows on like a river that homes to the sea. 1 hour bounding through mountain vales, 1 hour bounding through a lea. None may linger on the way, none may coax time to stay. Fleeting scenes move by us like a dream. Cling not, none will be your own. Never grieve to be alone. Go within you, there's your home.
Through many lives I've I've drunk the cup of laughter. No man could tell the pleasures I have known. The stars in the endless sky, if one could count, would come to billions. Yet as vast as are their numbers, so many years I've wandered far from you. Yet as vast as are their numbers, so many years I've wandered far from you. Through many lives I've drunk the cup of sorrow. No man could tell the bitter tears I've shed. The drops in the endless sea, if one could count, would come to billions. Yet as vast as are their numbers, so many years I've wandered far from you. Yet as vast as are their numbers, so many years I've wandered far from you. Through countless lives I've sought your cup of sweetness, found other cups, yet thirsted evermore. The streams in the hills of time all found their way into a desert. Every noon of bright fulfillment, ere many hours did sink to evening gloom. Every noon of bright fulfillment, ere many hours did sink to evening gloom. I long for you in summer and in winter, only for you my heart thirsts day and night. I've learned that the sweetest songs ears ever heard were but your echo. Lord, at last, fill me completely, for nevermore I'd wander far from you. Lord, at last, fill me completely, for nevermore I'd wander far.